really mad if we do.
Okay. With great deliberation, we opened the Senate Revenue Committee for a Friday session. Here's our order today. We are going to do a work session on 899. We will do, then we'll do the 841, the reserve fund. Then we'll do 853, the tax credit. And then we will do 896, the other water transit vehicle. We will not hear Senate Bill 845 on gift cards today. We will post that for Wednesday of next week and make a decision at that point. Open for a session on Senate Bill 899. Dennis Mulvihill, tell us about the Dash 6s.
Morning. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. Senate Bill 899-6 amendments do a couple of things. Simply put, it allows, first of all, it abolishes the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. Number two, it allows Multnomah County or any other county that reaches 500,000 in population as of July 1 of this year, as verified by PSU's Center for Population, to have or not have a commission as they see fit. That's simply what it does. So what it's doing is what I think where the committee was going to, where it moves it to the local level. It gets rid of Multnomah counties, but allows them, if they have the support of taxing jurisdictions representing 51% of the collections, tax collections, to create a commission, and that's for all counties. So it's decentralized this decision on whether or not to have a commission or not. And it spreads that decision between counties and the taxing jurisdictions. And that's for counties that are over 500,000. I should add, just as a footnote, that there for any county under 500,000, if you can put it out for a vote also and create one that way. So the whole state can have one if they wish, but it's decided at the county level.
We are all about local control. That is our motto.
Unless we don't like what they do, and then we...
And we're all about undoing local control.
Mr. Chair.
That's our next month. Yes, Senator Starr.
I'd move the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 899.
Senator Charles Starr has moved the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 899. Any discussion?
No.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this was a fascinating discussion we had in committee on this bill, and I do believe these amendments reflect, I think, the thoughts of the committee in that a lot of things have changed since 1919, and we don't do things the same way. It was amazing to find out that we had the Multnomah County Tax Supervising Conservation Commission eating up $280,000 for no apparent reason, and when there was adequate personnel to handle all those issues just like other jurisdictions. I thought it was really interesting, too, to have the testimony of the one individual who said he attended, he believed, just about every meeting of that commission over the last 10 years, and only one person ever showed up, and that was the janitor accidentally walked in looking for a cup of coffee. So I think this is good policy if Multnomah County has those has such a need for this commission still. This bill will allow them to reconstitute it, and if they have that much extra resources that they would like to reconstitute it, then gives them permission to do so. So I think this is good policy. It's permissive, but no longer will Multnomah County be able to say, well, we're wasting $280,000 because you make us. So I'm a strong supporter.
Great, and thank you for your comments. Senator Starr.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I agree with the senator from Welch's, but I do have a slight reservation in that it's obvious to me that this commission has provided tax reporting information that is more accessible to taxpayers than otherwise is possible. But I believe that local control should prevail, and so that's why I moved the Dash 6 amendments.
Good comments. Senator Bozanski.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would concur. I guess what I would translate from what my colleagues have said, it appears that this, at this point, is good local control, and we hope it doesn't become bad local control.
And in that case, we'll reassert ourselves.
That's right.
Dennis, you're wandering. Yes, sir.
Apologies for the phone going off. Could I say one thing about I appreciate the staff support on this one. Both legislative revenue staff and the folks that craft the laws for us to debate out here did extra work to produce this one in a very short period of time, and it's appreciated.
Mary, thank you. We're on Dash 6s, and was it Dexter? Dexter Johnson, thank you, and Legislative Council. Whenever we start going to the Dash 6s or Dash 7s, we know that you got us to the Dash 6s or Dash 7s. Any more discussion on Senate Bill 899? Any objections to the Dash 6s? So ordered. Senator Stock.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 899 as submitted by the Dash 6 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 6. He did that, and we got that done, and now he's moved the bill as a whole to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Who would like to carry that bill?
I'll do it.
Yeah. Senator Metzger. Close the work session on Senate Bill 899. Open a work session on Senate Bill 841. And this is the reserve fund issue that we have spent a couple days on earlier and now return to. This is the proposal that the Oregon and Lynn, if you want to kind of get close here, the Oregon Business Association has brought us on ending balances to help constitute that our reserve fund. Paul Warner.
Mr. Chair, I just made a copy again of your chart that summed up the proposals that you've considered over the last couple of months. And 841 is the statutory proposal that does commit general fund ending balance up to 2% to the reserve fund, to a newly created reserve fund, and has a cap of 10%, and the trigger is the same as the current education stability fund. A couple of things that I've done since the last meeting. I did prepare a revenue impact statement, which is not really a projected impact, but more of a historical look at what the how the stability fund of revenues would have come in since 1991 under 841. So you can see it's starting with 8991 biennium, you're basically meeting the 2% cap each biennium. The ending balance as a percent of the general fund was always in excess of 3.5% over that 10-year period. And you would have committed a total of $846 million to the reserve fund between 91 and 01. In 01, 03, and 03, 05, even though there was an ending balance that was positive, and remember in the case of 01, 03, you borrowed $450 million in appropriation credit bonds, which turned out to be a little bit more than was needed to, you know, to basically balance the budget, but you had to have some cushion there. But in the language of 841, if there is use of the fund during a given biennium, then there's not a deposit following that biennium. So I assume there wouldn't be any following 0103 and 0305 because of the use of the current education stability fund. In terms of adjustments to the bill, I have two amendments and then another policy issue for you to think about. based on discussions of the work group. And the Dash 1 amendment is a policy choice for you. It really comes based on discussions with Treasury. Under the current bill, the new reserve fund is set up separate and distinct from the general fund. The advantage of that is it's clearly distinct from the general fund and able to retain its own interest earnings, and that's in the bill that it does. And that, of course, allows it to grow faster. I do think we've been living in somewhat of an artificial period in terms of interest rates with short-term rates of 2 to 3%, and this could certainly become more significant over the next 5 to 10 years, would be my guess. However, what that does not allow is for the Treasury to use those balances in their cash management of the general fund. And the suggestion they had for the committee to look at, and that's the Dash 1 amendments, is to strike the delete and the separate and distinct language and make it a part of the general fund so that the Treasury would have that cash and would be able to use it to manage cash throughout the biennium. Now, the advantage of that is you would reduce your interest expenses. Rattan's expenses, we know, were $30 million last biennium. We're expecting those to be higher than that this coming biennium.
Does everyone recall TANs?
Tax anticipation notes, which the legislature gave Treasury the authority to do in 2002 in the first special session. So.
Just to cover our shortfall, just in cash flow.
Mm-hmm. And the cash flow issue, what our cash manager, Darren Bond, at Treasury calls a structural cash flow deficit because of the timing of your payments and the timing when revenue comes in. So by having it in the general fund, it would help manage that and reduce your interest expenses. The cost of doing that is you can't retain your interest earnings for the separate and distinct fund, so that the reserve fund would grow more slowly. So that's the trade-off in that decision. The other element that came up in the work group discussion was that another option of keeping the fund separate and distinct would be, rather than create a new fund, to have this the ending balance as a revenue source for the current Education Stability Fund. Now, I haven't asked for an amendment on that, but that would be another option for you. And then, of course, in that case, the cash flow issue would be off the table because it would be going into this constitutional fund. So that is one for you to ponder. The Dash 2 amendments are merely technical. You're looking at a percent of not the legislatively approved budget as in the original bill, but really the legislatively approved budget, which includes all actions of the E-Board and special sessions and so forth, minus reversions. So reversions come in after the biennium, and the language in the bill says that you don't transfer anything to the general fund until after December 31st following the biennium. So it's after the fact, and you would incorporate reversions in that calculation. So that's what the Dash 2s, they just make the bill consistent with that reversion-adjusted definition. So the policy choice is Senate Bill 841 with the Dash 1 amendments. If you want to keep it within the current general fund, you get some advantages in terms of cash flow and reducing interest costs, but you slow down growth of the fund. And the other option would be to rather than create a new fund, would be to use this as a revenue source for the Education Stability Fund. And then, of course, that raises the other issue, which you have in SGR 2 and SGR 19, and whether you want to raise the cap on the fund.
Mm-hmm. For the stability. So on the Dash 1s, what I guess if you look back historically, 10 or 15 years, although you're right, we're in a time of low interest rates, what would the state, had we had this in place in 1990, where would we have been advantaged the greatest by having it as a separate and distinct fund and garnering that interest? Or actually having it as a tool for cash management and not having to do the TANs and actually saving those interest costs? Can we say,
Mr. Chair, I think historically that's an easy one. I think that it definitely would have been an advantage to have it in a separate and distinct account because the general fund was running large ending balances. Mm-hmm. And the large ending balances were able to mask some of the cash flow problems. The other thing is the cash flow problems grew over time as the state school fund grew. And then you had that payment pattern that we've talked a lot about. But if you've got a large ending balance, and if you look on the revenue impact statement, we've averaged, there was no biennium between 89-91 and 99-01 that we had an ending balance that was below $338 million. So that gave the Treasury the liquidity and the cash flow to manage in the biennium. Now, where the problems have come up has been in recent biennia in which our ending balances are down considerably, and that's really squeezed the liquidity of the general fund and the amount of funds that the cash manager has to work with. So I think the real question is going forward, what will the next decade look like? My sense is the 90s were pretty unique. And I think we're more likely to see smaller ending balances and that interest option becoming that. That cash management option becoming more important.
Mm-hmm. So I'm almost hearing a recommendation that the 01, what we see in the 01, 03, folks are looking at their revenue impact might be perhaps more of a normal environment, which then sort of presents.
Yeah, I'm just going to follow up on what you're completing. I think that's exactly where we're going. When you look at where we've been and look at the philosophy that we've been running, most recently, I mean, we may go back to having a larger ending cash balance, but I'd say today it seems like that other alternative would be probably more prudent at this stage, and we could always come back if we get back to the point of having a larger ending cash balance and make the shift then.
The nice thing is this is statutory, and that's one of the nice things of this plan, that it is something we can continue to work with. Senator Starr?
Chair, I believe the Dash 1 amendments be most prudent, and I think a reasonable change to the bill. And so I would be in favor of moving that direction.
Okay. That's good counsel. Why the interest rate on TANs? I mean, maybe it's just because the TANs obligation was a big number, but there's a sticker shock when I hear that number of, what was it, $30 million just in interest that we paid on the TANs.
Mr. Chair, there's an issue. I think we've identified, and you've identified certainly with the forecast, a reporting issue that we haven't had reporting within our system that a framework that makes some sense for policymakers, and we've been working on that for the May forecast. And I think what you'll see, and that decision hasn't been finalized, but would be to, with your revenue impact statement, you would see a gross interest earnings of the general fund, because the general fund has cash balances at any point in time, so it generates interest earnings. But then below that, you'll have an interest expense. So you have a net interest revenue. And what would happen under that is you would see that it's not that the TANs are costing you money that interest expense you didn't have before. It's just more visible. And so the TANs are still a lower cost way of borrowing versus the interfund borrowing that the Treasury has done in the past, which was kind of masked by simply reporting this net figure. And the net figure was positive because of these big ending balances and having a large amount of cash to work with.
So do you think that would structurally lower the cost of money if we had to go out for TANs again, that by the work that we're doing would save us in terms of the cost of money or the interest rates that we're having to pay to get access to the TANs money? Or
Mr. Chair, you're talking about the Dash 2, using the Dash 1 amendments?
Not using them. If you wanted to just keep it separate and distinct, mm-hmm. and you said we want to focus our efforts on getting the best TANs environment we could improve VTANs interest rates by, I mean, some of the things we've discussed in terms of the forecast and other ways that we're accounting for, mm-hmm. if we do need to go out and actually, well, are we pretty, is that pretty solid?
Mr. Chair, I'm sure, I don't, I think the answer to that is no. I think Treasury has managed that as best they can, and the issue that I was really referring to was a reporting issue so that you know what the true costs are, and it's more visible for the policymakers to see, you know, what the net effect is and what gross and interest is. Because, of course, you remember the issue came up because we hadn't been recording it properly in the accounting system, and then all of a sudden it shows up as a big expense from a prior biennium. So that will be fixed and taken care of. But in terms of the cost to the state, it's pretty safe to assume that those interest expenses will rise.
Yeah, so there's nothing unique about the TANs that would, okay.
And I think we're in a rising interest rate environment, and possibly even a lot higher than what's being projected.
It's a separate but interesting issue that we'll have to grapple with. Lynn, please, Lundquist. Other questions for Paul? And Kate, do you want to come up and just be available to us? And Senator Morse, I'd offer you that too, if this is an issue you've followed and watched, and we appreciate any thoughts that you have also. Mr. Lundquist.
For the record, Lynn Lundquist, Oregon Business Association. First of all, I guess I have to preface my remarks with, I don't know perhaps the best, maybe what is the very best outcome in this. I do know the best outcome from the standpoint we need to do something. And I may have a little different opinion here, but the bottom line is we've got to do something. I think that's the thing I'd like to say first of all. I think it's a policy choice. When you look at whether you leave the account separate or not, from the standpoint, if you leave it separate, one of the advantages that I see politically is that if you put this in the general fund, there's that opportunity for the naysayers to say, oh, well, you know, you're just building, you know, you're just putting it right into the general fund. You're identifying separate, but, man, it's really easy to get to. That's political, but I think it is a consideration. The other another issue is that if you put it into the general fund and have the interest, let me ask you, Senator Deckard, the interest, if you put it in the general fund, the interest would go into the general fund, not into the account. Is that correct, the way it's?
Yeah, and that's why you're just going to have a slower.
Okay, so
your fund's just not going to.
So the fund will not grow as quickly. And that simply means that you're moving the fiscal impact of that from future activity into present activity. In other words, when we get down the road and you actually need this fund, whenever that is, then your fund's going to be smaller, assuming we haven't capped it out. And I think that's a trade-off, and I think, you know, reasonable people could probably argue on both sides of that issue. Having the history of where we've come from, and maybe I'm sensitive more so to the fact that, you know, we just had ourselves dug in a hole and we didn't have anything there. And I'm probably leaning towards the idea that if you kept it separate and distinct, that in the long run that would be advantageous. But that's a policy decision, and I'm open to either one of those. If you want to talk about the issue that staff raised in regard to putting it into the stability fund, I think, again, one of the political dangers that I see in doing that is that that will not be, at least in very long term, hopefully we will have to have that cap raised on the stability fund. And that means you have a vote of the people, and I'm all for that. But it also creates a challenge for you. That has to pass the vote of the people. Otherwise, by putting it in there, we can reach that cap, and then we have a 5% cap out of the present situation, which is simply not enough.
Yeah, what percent are we at?
5%.
But I know where the cap is, but where are we at with sorry to interrupt, Lynn. The dollars, you know, based ballpark.
Mr. Chair, and then assuming the current forecast for lottery, we would be at about It's a little over, I think it's $201 million for an ending balance following the 05-07 buy-in for the Stability Fund. General Fund will be about 11.4. So we would be less than 2%.
Less than 2%. So we're not going to hit that 5%. I mean, that's the whole debate we're having of why do you go to the people at this point to even bump the cap? Because you're not going to get... I mean, when would we actually... Say we do 841 and we put it in the Stability Fund. When would you actually get to that 5% even if, you know, rosy projections?
Well, it could speed it up if remember the way 841 is designed is you make the transfer after the biennium. So, you know, if the forecast we come in short on the forecast, you won't make any contribution to the fund. But it, you know, up to 2% could put you up, at over $200 million following the biennium. So. You know, you could grow by an additional $200 million a biennium. So it would get you there. Probably the soonest you could get there would be the 09-11 biennium.
09-11. Yeah.
Senator Decker, if I follow and help me through here, the lottery contribution to the Education Stability Fund this time will be what? $200 million, did you say?
The ending balance will be $200 million. The lottery contribution, in fact, I've got SGR 19 here. The lottery contribution is for 07-09 is 175. For 05-07 is 168.
So Senator Decker, if you add these two together. If I'm following this correctly, it wouldn't happen by June 30th, but by the activity of this biennium that you're working on, the 0507, you could be close to $400 million. Am I following that correctly? Between the combination? You have the lottery proceeds going in, which are $175 million, and you have the imbalance going in, which is $200 million. So round it off, you're in $350-400 million. Mm-hmm. So you're already... At 5% of the general fund is $500 million. Am I a little more than that? 550 or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Well, but if you 0507 projected at $200 million, and let's say that we do following 0507 biennium, that you do make a full 2%, that would put you about 400. So you're going to be below at the end of 0507. At the end of 0709, you would be close. It could be at the end, following 07-09 or in the 09-11 biennium.
Yeah. So if projections followed, you put this in the Stability Fund, you could be there around 09-010 in that period hitting your 5%.
You could be there with the transfer following the 07-09 biennium. That would be made in January of 2010.
Yeah. So if we're pinning it, that would be...
If everything goes according to trend, that would be where we would be.
So that's the point I was trying to make, is that I think not this next one, but the one after that, you will hit that cap. So it's not a long ways off. I mean, I would argue we need to have a higher cap if we're going to have an all-in fund. I don't care about putting one fund. That's fine with me. But you do have to go through that step. And... I was trying to keep this originally simple and keep it distinct so that we sort of kept away from some of that because it is statutory.
Yeah.
But I certainly am not opposed to that. I was just trying to point out some of the issues involved.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the idea of putting it in the Stability Fund. I guess the downside would be just cash management at that point, is that you could incur greater interest just in managing the cash flow of the state. Kate?
For the record, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your assessment is correct, Chair Deckert. I will say, though, from the Treasurer's policy choice that he sees that competing policy choice, and if he were sitting in your chair, he would put it in the Education Stability Fund despite the impact to the cash management for the reasons that it it is constitutionally protected once it's in the Education Stability Fund. And it's a statutory, regardless, this 841 is a statutory direction of those monies to the Education Stability Fund, which could be changed later even if a cap were not. If you went out to the voters and did not achieve extension of the cap, you could, once you reach that point, you then could remove putting the transfer into the Education Stability Fund. But he, well, since he was very instrumental in helping establish that Education Stability Fund, and because the rating agencies recognized that as a positive move, the legislature did put in place, and it has the stronger sideboards on it than a statutory reserve fund. As he's testified here before you, and I think written a letter to you as well, that's what it's there for. So he would support that, the policy choice of putting in the Education Stability Fund. At the same time, if you chose not to do that for other reasons, he would, on 841, if there was a statutory reserve fund for the cash management reasons, he would prefer for it to be not separate and distinct from the general fund. And I want to make one clarification about that. There are many funds within or accounts within the general fund that are dedicated. They cannot be used as part of the general fund. I mean, they're used for the general fund as far as cash flow, and then we can do the interfund borrowing. It keeps our cash balance up. But they separate, if it's all statutory, it's all statutory. And it doesn't protect it anymore from in being separate and distinct. It just means that it has that interest on the other side. And his point about the interest that you would gain in having it separate and distinct is that, well, you're increasing your cost in another arena, so the actual interest you're gaining, if you net out the cost you're creating in one place against the interest you're earning in the other fund, you may not be gaining as much as it appears.
Huh. But that's the whole dash one issue, correct?
Right. That's the dash one issue. So from a priority point of view, and the treasurer's policy recommendation would be to put it, if you chose to do that, put it in the Education Stability Fund for that greater protection as a rainy day fund. If you chose not to do that for other reasons, then he would ask that it be a part of the general fund.
General fund. And if it went in the stability fund, it has all the protection. Once it's in there, all of the, it's a lot safer at that, or safer from us at that point of spending it.
From you, maybe.
Well.
Mr. Chair, I think the rationale in creating the Education Stability Fund with those constitutional sideboards was protect us from ourselves. But it was to demonstrate that the seriousness of putting that money aside.
And I'm sure it's going to help with bond rating agencies to have those kind of protections in place.
They were pleased with the security of that fund.
One thing I might add, Mr. Chair, it may, under this kind of scenario, if we're thinking optimistically here with no recession for a while, you could be at the cap sooner and just recall that there is a sub-account that the money would flow into, the school capital matching sub-account.
Oh.
So that's a piece of that scenario. So once you get to the 5%, then it goes in this other account and you would dedicate it to school capital.
Senator Starr, that's not a bad for faster growing school districts. Senator Shaw.
In order to get there from here, we've got to have more amendments drafted.
That is correct.
And I would not be opposed to that.
Senator Metzger.
It was interesting, Lynn, on your written testimony. A sentence here that we haven't really talked about, which I think is very valid, and you talk about how this is a blend of policy and politics, and I think of that in terms of this discussion. And one thing we haven't talked about, we have I think we did great work in establishing the Education Stability Fund, It is, as we have discussed previously, really is the rainy day fund. I mean, it provides the money. Since education is half the budget, as other people have made it very clear and reminded, it is half the budget. That essentially frees up money for others. It is the rainy day fund. The problem is, we're not talking about the politics. We also have spending limitations, but other people have expenditure limitations. We've passed a couple of them, 99 and 01, but others have been able to convince within the building and out of the building that we need a spending limitation, expenditure limitation, even though we have it. Somehow we're able to convince ourselves we don't have what we already have. What we have with this situation here is that I think there is a compelling need of some people to say we have to have a reserve fund, even though we have one, because we have the vernacular of the building is that, this is a must-do. And going and talking to the general public about, well, we do have that, it's the Education Stability Fund, ignores the political point that somebody has to have, a separate and distinct reserve fund. And I guess my only concern about putting the money in the Stability Fund, which from a money management and, prudent purposes, is absolutely makes sense. I wonder if it really solves the political problem where we're still going to have other people say we need a reserve fund and have to go through this exercise again because it doesn't fulfill that particular need of folks. And does that really solve that problem? And I guess that's my only concern. We lock into a stability fund in which we have a cap and it's growing and we have other people out speaking to the world that we still don't have a reserve fund. And I just wonder if we're almost over-noodling this so much that 841, not making it separate and distinct, may actually still fulfill both of our needs and those in the building. And that's my only concern is that, I don't know, this ends the reserve fund talk, no matter how much money's there.
Although if it's at 5%, I mean, the question now is it adequate reserve fund? And 5% gets us closer to what we've discussed as closer to adequate or the national standard seems to be 8 to 10%.
But we'll have the same money, whether we pass this or whether we do the other. I just wonder that if the idea is now we've done good work, we're putting an additional revenue stream into the stability fund, I'm not convinced that it's going to stop the discussion in this building about still creating another reserve fund, if not now, next session. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do happen to endorse and have for quite some time the creation of a stability fund, given the volatility of our income. But the one thing that just has not been addressed in this whole discussion, and that's the structural deficit that we currently have in our system. Clearly, our revenues do not support all of the programs and the policies that are put in place. They just don't support it. And if you look at the current budgets that are in dispute now between the Senate and the House, there are not sufficient revenues. And before we enact legislation to create a fund, a reserve fund, out of current revenues, we need to have a complete and thorough evaluation of what this structural budget gap is. Because this, if we enact something that just compounds a problem that we have not addressed, then we have not solved the problem, we've compounded the problem. And my concern is that in the building, uniformly, we have just refused to come to grips with the most serious of all problems, and that's this structural budget gap. And if we're going to create a fund like this, there are program eliminations that have to occur because we cannot continue to support all the things that are on the table. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there's a part of this discussion that's yet to be held in the building about it's a very, very structural issue that we're facing, and it is very serious. What we're doing is we're trying to thin the soup. We have eliminated, but we've not come to grips with what that structural deficit is. We need ending fund balances that will work. We need reserve funds that will sustain us when we have downturns in the economy so we don't throw kids out of school. That's very sound fiscal policy. But if we're driven towards just what's politically expedient, I'm not sure that that is the correct course of action. And I guess the bill that we have before us under certain circumstances would work great. But I don't think we've solved the conditions precedent to get us to that point. And I think we have to have that discussion in the building. And with all due respect to all of my colleagues, I don't think we've had that discussion yet.
So, Senator Morris, how would you, I'm very sympathetic to how would you proceed? And what we're trying to grapple with is this is one way of taking any ballot that's statutory so it doesn't go to the voters and lock into the Constitution. But what course to help really foster that debate that I think is needed in terms of there's just too many calls on the state budget for revenues available, and it's only going to, I mean, we've talked a lot about, if you look at how we've structured this with the lottery and federal transfers, it's only going to get most likely worse, even in a growing economy. The hard thing, at least for myself, is walking away from a good opportunity to start building that reserve fund today when folks seem at least building it to 5%. But I'd welcome your counsel.
What I believe would be appropriate would be, and we've got excellent staff, would be to have legislative revenue and legislative fiscal do the analysis of current revenues, projected revenues, what we have before us, even in the near term and in the long term, the kinds of issues that require fiscal balance in our system. Give us that projection. What is this structural deficit that we currently face today? And by definition, if it's structural, it means it's not temporary. It's an ongoing issue. And how serious is this issue? We've not had that analysis. And I think that's the first place to start, is to understand really what is this structural and how large is it? Because if you look at today's both budgets that are being advanced, the ending fund balance in these budgets is so small, given the known contingencies or the known liabilities, the unknown contingencies, and the need for some measure of ongoing stability with an ending fund balance, they're both woefully inadequate. And the reason they're so small is because the demand far exceeds our ability to supply with revenue. So I don't want to get into editorializing the big picture, but my concern is that we look at the bigger picture of revenue and this structural budget gap that we have and make an informed choice. This bill may in fact be the best bill, but when we're taking current revenues out of a structural budget gap, we've compounded our problem. We've exacerbated the problem. Mm-hmm. And if we're willing to step up and do the eliminations to bring us into balance structurally, then this bill is a very reasonable bill.
Mm-hmm. Senator Stein.
I couldn't agree more with Senator Morris. What we fail to do is to identify those cost drivers that are exceeding our ability to fund programs, and we know, I think, intuitively what some of those are. We know that our future here is only gets more dark if we don't deal with those programs that have been instituted, and I've been a party to that now for 7 sessions, introducing new programs that are very important to a constituency out there, but we have not evaluated where we can find revenues to sustain a program that's new, and whether it is accomplishing all the good that we envision for the greatest good for all the people. And I think that we tend to just put it off because, well, we can get by another session. But it only gets thinner and thinner. And, you know, the K-12 budget that we're seem to be at impasse over means $100 million in that budget means so little to the schools when you spread it out there. But it means so much to Project Independence and some other programs, higher ed and public safety and other issues that we're facing. We really need the debate about whether we continue to try to support all the programs that we have before us. And if we do recognize that the people have very strongly said no more taxes, we have the potential of a cap on spending that potentially would be on the ballot. If we don't deal with these issues here, then it'll be dealt with in another way that is less than deliberative, I think. So I appreciate that Senator Morris keeps bringing this issue to us and that we have not had that discussion. When, if not now, will we have it? Mm-hmm. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, thank you. Let's go to Senator Brzezinski and then Ms. Lindquist.
Yeah, I think Senator Starr's comments are very worthy of, you know, the situation we find ourselves in. And I really think as much as we were willing to beat ourselves up as to not tackling the issue, I also go back to what Senator Morris has really elaborated through the last two sessions, and I know I've carried that towards some, but not to the degree he has. I mean, those cost drivers, we know where some of those are. I mean, when you look at some of the stuff that's been passed by the voters, the initiatives that have been passed that demand money to be spent, and we have no guidance as to how we actually put that into the existing revenues or how we're going to ever get on top of that. I mean, it's just one of those things. I mean, you look at the public safety. We all want to be safe. We all want to make sure our kids are able to move freely without worrying about them being harmed. And you look at some of the other issues that are out there on the public safety side, and that's the cost driver. I mean, when you look at how much we're pushing our cost and we're not making those decisions, if that's where we are setting our priorities as Oregonians, then we have to give somewhere else, or we have to bring in the additional revenue to pay for those new demanded services. And I think we all have our feelings and I guess knowledge as to what some of those are, and I'm not saying what I'm putting on the table today is it, because we do have demands. I mean, I have constituents wanting certain things to be brought forward, and we put them in there. We have the process through the committees with Ways and Means. Can we fund this or can we not? And so, it does continue on. But, the initiative process, as much as I support it, there is not accountability at this point. I know that Senator Morris and I have talked, and I think we're going to hopefully bring some stuff before the the body to discuss and maybe consider putting some accountability on that side of the equation, as much as we need to have those considerations for what we do here in the building. Mr. Chair, I guess the other thing is that if it's something that this committee wants to do is set up a reserve fund, possibly could we set the fund up without necessarily trying to fully fund it or set it up with as much funding at this point, but establish something that's there if that's what we need to do. I mean, Senator Rexers makes an excellent point. We do actually have a reserve fund. It's just dedicated into the education arena, but as he says, it's almost half of the general fund expenditures. And if we need to be having multiple reserve funds for these various interests that we have, I mean, so be it. Maybe we need to have another one to do that. And maybe on the political side, that's why we need to put it out there, to try to keep some of the mantra that's outside of this building from being able to be expressed as harsh as it has been.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think that this is one of the issues we have as a citizen legislature that meets here 6 or 7 months every 2 years. We just do not have the ability to address, because when we're in the interim, I mean, you look at how long it takes us to get the interim committees up and running. We have maybe a year, 12 months, if we're lucky, and probably closer to only 10 months to actually start trying to meet. And these are issues that, I mean, they are very large, need a lot of input from citizens across the state. I mean, what we've done in the Senate and what the House is now doing by going out to the communities, having our committees meet in local areas, getting us more engaged and allowing the people to be more engaged, that's what we need to be doing during the interim. And some of these issues, and having those open discussions and talking about the responsibilities that we all have as our guardians. And if we're going to really have someone manage the largest corporation in the state, which is the state, you know, how do we do that?
Mm-hmm. The only 2 cents I'd throw on the table is I do think it would be a mistake for us to, because the reserve fund, I'm convinced that we have, given the volatility of our income tax, is just too small. Just the stability fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though, I think the structural deficit is a correct issue, but to not do it in a biennial legislature and to not do something around a reserve fund and at least slowly building it to 5% in what we heard January 1st, 2010 is the best state we could get. Because Paul mentioned we could, you know, interest rates could spike well beyond where they're projected to go. And if I just think if the economy dipped again, we would look back at this session, and it very well could, and next year we would look back at this session and think, well, they had an opportunity at least to put a couple hundred million more into reserves. And that's where, I mean, we're going to get the speaker's plan in this committee, and that's where I'm intrigued about. Maybe partly what you have to do is you just dedicate a certain percentage of your income tax, if that's your revenue stream, to schools, and then say to local communities at that point, that's all the state can do. And then it's up to local communities to make decisions. But that is all the state can possibly do. Lynn, you wanted to get in on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree with my good friend, I can say it's here today, Senator Morris. What I'd like to add to that is somewhat along you said is that, yes, that needs to happen, what the good senator talked about. But I don't see that this precludes that from happening. I think the need is there to have some reserve. Maybe that's the economist and the agriculturalist in me, having been through those kind of really tough times and knowing that you just can't function in a fiscally responsible manner when you don't have some type of reserve for, as you've indicated, a very volatile tax system. So I don't think that should take away from that action. I would love to see the legislature come out and fix that problem. I guess I'd have to be honest, I'm not sure that you can do that between now and 1st of July or whenever it is. But I think we have an opportunity here, and my concern is this, is that I think there's a resolve in this building that I've never seen before to do something along the line of reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And if we miss that opportunity, I think it can go away as times get better, and we'll be back to where we were in the 90s and didn't do anything. And I'm sorry, I was part of that. So I'm,
you tried.
I'm tried. But I just think we should not avoid the opportunity, not avoid, we should not miss the opportunity. Because it has this, you should have reserve fund irregardless of how good or how poor your fiscal policy is.
You should have reserve fund. Correct. Okay, any final thoughts? I think what I'd like to do is get follow Senator Starr's recommendation that we have something drafted that would put this money into the stability fund, and we'll reschedule this for Thursday or Friday of next week. Close the work session on Senate Bill 841. Open a work session on, if you're here for gift cards,
That is going to be scheduled for Wednesday of next week. Open a work session on Senate Bill 896. Mr. Yates, yeah, if you would like to come up.
I saw Senator Starr out there, too. So.
He stepped out again.
It's Elizabeth.
Please talk to us about this opportunity that we've been kind of tracking here in this committee.
Well, thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Dan Yates. I am president of American Waterways, which is an employee, family-owned business in Portland that operates the Portland Spirit and three sister vessels. I'm going to do a little background on our industry and talk about how the opportunity then applies to Oregon. The United States has over 8,000 commercial vessels that carry passengers, about 300 million people a year. Passenger vessel industry is comprised of dinner boats, charter boats, excursion vessels, water taxis, conventional ferries, fast ferries, and casino boats. The fastest growing segment of our industry is the fast ferry segment. The United States has been very slow to adopt fast ferry technology due to regulatory and financial constraints. Due to our self-imposed structural constraints, we have fallen dramatically behind Europeans and Asians in adopting fast ferries. To close the gap, American shipyards have been licensing overseas designs and shipbuilding technology to build domestic fast ferries. Our domestic shipyards and operators are protected by the U.S. Coast Guard from inferior design and unproven materials, while the Jones Act, another federal law, ensures that all vessels working in domestic ports are constructed here, maintained in the United States, and are manned only by Americans. Only recently has our domestic market been allowed to take advantage of technical advances in ship design and new materials. The U.S. Coast Guard took 40 years to approve fiberglass as a material that can be used in a commercial craft. That's how slow they are to adopt new technology. If you ever rode a dinner boat in the 80s and noticed that every carpet on every dinner boat was the same, it's because the Coast Guard didn't think it was necessary to approve more than one color of carpet. And they're a very careful organization. And so,
nicely put.
Yeah, that was very polite for me. The domestic ferry market is growing rapidly, and it's grown from about 100 ferry operations in the 80s to almost 500 companies today. About half of the companies are private-public joint ventures, and the remaining half split between government-owned and privately owned. This growth has been spurred by technological advancements and traffic congestion. As a society, we're running out of places to build more roads, and yet our increasing population is demanding an ever-expanding rate of mobility. Ferries have become part of the solution to offer alternative transit options to expensive and inflexible rail systems and buses that are stuck in the same traffic jams that commuters are seeking to avoid. The water represents the last open right-of-way for government to move people through. Historically, ferries have been restricted by slow speeds due to hull design and manufacturing limitations. Fast ferries, which are vessels that travel in excess of 35 knots, have rapidly gained acceptance because of their ability to overcome historical limitations. Fast ferries have been used in Europe and Asia for the last 15 years and have dramatically improved in performance and design. There are ferries going over 50 knots that carry over 100 vehicles and 1,000 people in the same load. The world has looked to fast ferries to cross wide bodies of water quickly and efficiently. In the last few years, the role of fast ferries has evolved with technology to work in restricted waters. Creative hull designs, new propulsion systems, and new hull materials have created opportunities for companies like New York Waterways, a private company that carries about 100,000 people daily on 30 vessels in Manhattan. Their success at providing a speedy alternative was so successful that the Staten Island ferry system was forced to reduce their fare to zero to maintain ridership, because they're big, slow vessels, and people, time is very important to them, so they're willing to pay more. In Seattle, a private company has started passenger-only service on a fast ferry, and if successful, will add more vessels rapidly. In San Francisco, they have about 35 vessels, and they're hoping to add at least 200 more over the next decade. As fast ferries in the United States have been, all fast ferries in the United States have been constructed out of aluminum and are long and narrow beam. Aluminum is used as it is strong and lightweight, and vessels are long and slim to reduce weights.
Speeds greater than 20 knots in conventional V-shaped hulls create a wall of water in the form of a destructive wake. Over the last 15 years, hull designs have had the greatest rate of change in the history of man. Changes are still happening, with the latest Great Leap still being refined. I believe the best hull design for restricted water that generates extremely low wake, incredible fuel efficiency, high speeds, and tremendous hull strength is called the Harley Craft. I have invested thousands of dollars of research, visited shipbuilders around the country, and have attended many marine conferences over the last 5 years, and have concluded that the Harley Craft is the future craft for restricted water operations. Howard Harley has been working with Kevlar, which is, I'm sure you're familiar from the Iraq War, is armored plating, but it's a composite material that is incredibly strong and is used in bulletproof vests, framing of airplanes, and armored plating by the military. About 8 years ago, Mr. Harley started to explore using Kevlar in a radical new hull design. The U.S. military has identified a need for large freighters to be able to transport to the Middle East in half the time they presently take. Harley proposed his hull design, claiming it can be built in large versions and obtain the desired speed and payloads. Over the last few years and millions of government dollars, Harley has refined his design and built an operating prototype. This prototype is only 55 feet long, with an 80-foot version in the process of being constructed. While testing the 55-foot prototype, it was discovered that the new hull design was almost completely wake-free at 60 miles per hour. The hull is made out of Kevlar and has a unique air cushion design. Literally, the boat has five diesels, one in the bow, four for propulsion. The one in the bow operates two blowers to push air underneath the boat, doesn't lift it completely out of the water, leaves about 10 inches of the hull in the water. What it does is significantly reduces drag on the boat, but it also gives tremendous fuel efficiency. What was completely unexpected was that the virtually no wake, which that's absolutely key, because if you're going to operate in rivers, which are the predominant source of opportunities for this product, is that a conventional wake is created by the hull being driven through the water, and all a wake is energy transference. And so the easiest way for boat builders to get rid of that energy was to push water out, and so that's where you get your wake. The hull design actually takes the energy and pushes it down. And if you have 15 feet of water below the keel, all the energy is dissipated before it goes about 14 feet below. So there is virtually no wake. And I was very skeptical of this. I've been to Tampa. I've ridden on his boat. We were on a very restricted waterway. We were going about 60 miles an hour, and we went by two guys in a 12-foot rowboat with their little fishing lines out, and we were about 50 feet away, and we went flying right by them. I didn't even move their boat. It was absolutely remarkable. So, but there are some problems with this technology. The biggest problem with it is that Kevlar is a very slow material to work with. In our industry, financing is a key component, and because of 9/11, we lost our biggest financer of these 8,000 pleasure boats. About 60% of them were owned by Safeco Insurance, or financed by Safeco Insurance. They had to get out of the business because of a very bad investment that they had that really became exposed in 9/11. So we've lost our primary financing agent in our industry. So our industry is in a lot of shakeout. But the predominant reason that we are having trouble getting any sort of financing to buy one of these is that they take almost 2 years to build. Conventional financing in the marine industry is only comfortable to about a one-year build. And so there would have to be some sort of stopgap to provide a construction loan guarantee to help stimulate getting these things built. That's just one a main concern that I have on this type of building.
Mr. Yates, just on that, and maybe, I mean, this is really the question that the reason we're looking at a new tax credit, which we haven't done at all this session, I think in both chambers, a new tax credit. But this one's interesting, and it's just the possibility that manufacturing jobs would come here that otherwise wouldn't. And
I was going to get to that.
Okay, you're gone. I'm sorry to...
No, that's right.
But that really is the heart of the question for us is,
Right.
Senator Starr brought this idea, and it definitely some flags went up of, there could be some.
Well, this is why I think there's an opportunity for Oregon. This technology, boats, you either build a boat on the West Coast or the East Coast in the United States. We know that San Francisco is already going ahead with a program to acquire a couple hundred, possibly 300 more boats. I personally see a need for about 30 of these just in the Willamette alone. There's already starting a conversation of about a $1.2 billion financing for a new bridge over the Columbia. I think it's a little premature to talk about that without exploring all the options. I know that on the last go-around or the first go-around on this, that ferries were specifically excluded from the discussion. I know that because I went and testified and was told not to come back. That's a political issue, but that person is no longer in power, so I think ferries have an opportunity to be brought up and discussed. Especially if you're talking about a billion-dollar investment in this community, in the Portland metropolitan area. Oregon has a long shipbuilding history, and we haven't constructed a ship in probably about 5 years. The last ship we did build was a ferry for Tacoma. But I believe that there's an opportunity for a West Coast shipbuilder to supply the market with these vessels. There is no one on the West Coast in the small shipbuilding business that builds anything out of composite material. And the primary shipbuilder in the small shipbuilding market, which is Nichols Brothers up in Whidbey Island, has been basically overwhelmed with military contracts.
Yeah. Can I have Senator Starr, just because I need to ask him one thing.
Yep.
We're thinking about moving this bill, and we'll go right back. Actually, your testimony is the pivotal testimony, Ms. Chase, because you know this industry, and and you're the one who actually can convince us that this actually could happen. Senator Starr, I don't want to preclude you from getting to your other. One thing I would need is a 10-year or 15-year sunset. I'm happy to, if you nod, to do that in the House, if that's something that you're willing to look at, as some sort of sunset.
Absolutely.
It's a new tax credit.
No, Mr. Chair, for the record, Senator Brewer, District 15. Again, I appreciate you scheduling and then rescheduling this bill so we had an opportunity to have Mr. Yates provide his testimony. Dan and I have had conversations about this. I think there's an opportunity here that maybe wouldn't be here except that the state take some incentive or provide some incentive for the investments to come here. I think we'll hear some more from Mr. Yates about what those opportunities are here in Portland. A sunset, I understand that. I think that that's appropriate. It will bring back the issue back in front of the legislature to deal with. We'll have the opportunity to look at the success or not of this particular tax credit, and we can reassess at that point in time whether we extend it or eliminate it or eliminate the tax credit. I think that's an appropriate thing, and I would support. Let's give the industry some time to utilize this incentive. So, if Dan thinks 15 years is enough or 12 years is enough or whatnot, but I would look at maybe a nod from Dan as far as where to put that sunset. But I would be happy to do that and be happy to do that in the House if that's the will of this committee.
Right, so maybe we'll, sorry, Mr. Chase.
No problem.
Senator Starr, one thing I've also would like to consider in these type of situations where we're starting these expanded tax credits, besides the sunset, is some type of clawback that if we allow industries to receive these type of credits, that there's a commitment to being here beyond the length of the credit and actually being part of our community and stuff. And so
I think that's appropriate, and I think Mr. Yates can talk about it. If a company comes and makes a significant investment, that's a commitment, and clearly economics play in this whole discussion. So I would let Mr. Yates to answer that question. Mr. Chair, if I can be excused, I need to run down the hall and testify on another bill.
Thank you. So just for clarity, if we do move it, you'll work with us to ensure we get some sort of 10-year, 12-year sunset.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And sure. Senator Posansky, just on that, to me, if they made the manufacturing commitment to come here, to me, that is a big enough investment that...
And I'm not saying it's not, Mr. Chair.
Just to assure you, shipyards are huge capital upfront costs. And as generous as a tax credit may seem, it might be enough to push someone to locate here to do that. But I guarantee you that it will be 1% or 2% of the overall consideration, because it is just a mold for one of these boats is about $1 million. You got to make it here. And so it's a huge investment, not counting land, not counting even going through the process of getting your DSL lease, which can be interesting all above in and of itself. Although we do have a few shipyards that have gone out of business the last couple of years in the Portland area alone, that would be available, I think, to restart.
Mm-hmm. If I could ask Mr. Yates, you know, shipbuilders, if they're moving from location to location, or how often they relocate their operations, not going out of business, but actually relocating.
We have probably a dozen small ship operations, built shipbuilders in the United States, and I cannot think of anyone that has moved. I know that the Nichols brothers in Whidbey Island, because of the local government, has put tremendous restrictions on them that they cannot work after like 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
So they can't work three shifts.
Right.
So they've actually had to build large buildings so that the boats can be moved inside and worked on inside, so they can actually work a second and a third shift. But I've not heard of any shipyards moving. I know them all pretty well, because it's a small community. Actually, even in this country, it's a small community.
Well, I appreciate that, not Mr. Chair. I mean, that is a commitment, but also understanding and hearing Mr. Yates say that it's not a type of, let's say, box company or that can basically pick up and move their whole industry somewhere else.
No. Now, they could theoretically get out of ship manufacturing and go to ship repair. That is something that people do. But any yard that would set up this work on composite material vessels would not be I can't see them going off and working on aluminum vessels and steel vessels. Those are completely different technologies. So I would this would be predominantly a production facility.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. We have to drill down, especially on anything new, and that's where you hear the sunset talk and ensuring that all that capital investment is there, even though it is on something like this probably a very small fraction of the investment the private
right.
folks would have
but
to make.
It's if no one, I do not know of another state that has even considered this.
Yeah.
And I think that it puts us in a competitive advantage that might be enough to actually kickstart it, which is kind of exciting. Because there's something else that just recently happened. Senator Cantwell from the state of Washington was able to get, I believe it was about $30 million from the federal government to start a composite material research facility for airplanes in the Seattle area. Well, it's composite. Kevlar is actually used all through Boeing airplanes. And so this was a way of helping Boeing. And I've been talking to our federal legislators about getting a composite material research facility for marine applications in Oregon. And having a tax credit for water transit vehicles, which the only one that really makes any sense is a composite material. I've talked to Howard Harley. He's interested in locating a western site. He's a little distracted right now because he has a few million dollars more to play with the federal military money. His latest contract is about up, and we're actually in the process of trying to purchase his 80-foot prototype
and bring it out here so we can actually put it into service on a commercial run for ourselves to prove to ourselves that technology will work.
So when you talk to, and this gets right up for us, targeting a sunset date, when you talk to Mr. Harley or someone else that might actually be interested in using this to manufacture, it has a January 1st or 06. So do you think 10 years out would be enough of a commitment from that date, from January 1st to, so that gets you to, so you could say, through January 1st, 2016, this tax credit's in place?
I think that's perfectly adequate.
Time period for mm-hmm. them to look at things.
Because I can't, even if we got a if a shipyard made a commitment today, they couldn't start operating for a couple of years.
Yeah,
this is not, other than this room right here, this is not the most business friendly state. It took me 2 years to get the Portland Spirit started, mm-hmm. and the only reason Portland was the last city in the United States without a dinner boat is because every major company in the United States tried all through the early 90s to put a boat in Portland, and they could not work their way through the state and local regulatory system. It was just impossible. Portland has, as a city, has really forgotten that it is a marine dependent, or was originally a marine dependent, and it doesn't have any of the systems in place to deal with marine activities. Now, I can't say that for the rest of the state, because my experience is in Portland. But I do know that we've had an explosive growth of overnight cruise ships on the Columbia River. We're up to about 9 now, and we're home porting. We just lost one to Vancouver because they couldn't get any assistance in Portland, to home port in Portland. But it was about a $60 million boat, which would have been nice in the property tax rolls, and another 250 jobs. But we don't see them very much because they're only docking here one night a week, because it's a 7-day cruise in the Columbia and the Snake. Mm-hmm. But it is genuine business that has been growing pretty quickly. And Portland doesn't have any plan on how to deal with it. And it's been very frustrating for me. So I probably would envision the shipyard being located out of Portland.
In Oregon. Which?
Somewhere in Oregon, Astoria or maybe somewhere up the Columbia. Hmm. But I don't know where. I know we talk about the business environment in Oregon is getting better, but I think the proof is in the tax revenues. Hmm. And I heard the gentleman talk about the revenues improving, and maybe the forecast. I am a Umpqua Bank, who is our bank that uses us as a bellwether for the local economy, and we've actually reversed our first 4 years of declines. We're down 20% from our top, and we're going to grow a couple percent this year, which isn't exactly an amazing turnaround by any stretch. And I think that we've worked hard to create an economy that is very weak, and we'll be first in to the next recession again, because we have not addressed the structural issues, which I know there was a little talk about this earlier today, but as a state we don't. We just go on to the next problem. So, but I think this is actually a step in the right direction to talk about encouraging business through a tax credit, and that may be used, and if it is used, it will only be a benefit to the community.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we're ready to move on it, because there just seems to be only an upside and incentive.
What's the downside? If it gets, the only downside is that it gets used and it creates jobs and creates tax base.
Exactly.
So philosophically, I'm not very much in favor of handouts and tax credits. I'm much more into fiscal responsibility. But if we can create jobs, and add to the tax base.
I think the case has been made, and we're definitely appreciative of your time and your ability to come down and sell the case, because we needed that.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'm ready to go with this, but I do have one other question.
Oh, sure.
I'm assuming that these type of jobs for the shipbuilders would be family wage jobs.
I know that term is used a great deal. I'm not really sure what that means, but I'm sure that knowing shipyard wages, that they're somewhere in the area of $20 an hour plus. You can't be competitive and hire quality people in the shipyards without offering, because it's skilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
And
I just want to put that on the record. I would assume it would be somewhere at least that.
Yeah,
I
just
a minimum wage job.
I would love to see him less than that, but only as a ship owner. But the labor rates in shipyards are pretty consistent throughout the region, and at least on the repair side. And I'm sure construction, because it's even more skilled when you're building something from nothing.
Thank you.
And that's the global. I mean, that's just the global issue of where these trying to get them here.
Well, you got to remember though, any boat we are protected, and so. Every boat operating in the United States has to be built here. All of it has to be built here, all the hull. So you can be comfortable it's being built somewhere in the 50 states.
Well, this hopefully will help us. So we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash-1 amendments to Senate Bill 896.
Senator Metzger moves the Dash-1 amendments to Senate Bill 896. Any discussion on that amendment? Lizbeth, could you get a sunset for the drafted that works off that 06 date?
Sure.
And gives a 10-year window?
Mm-hmm.
Any other discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Metzger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 896 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved Senate Bill 896 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. Senator Brewster will carry that bill. And unless there's someone here from, and ma'am, you would be it, from the foundations of our universities, and that the head shakes no, we will not do Senate Bill 853.
Senator Morrison's.
Did he want to come back and talk to us about 853?
He said he was going to come down. He was in the Secretary of State's office.
On 853? Okay, I'll wait. Committee, he's in the Secretary of State's office. We'll stand at ease.
Approximately 5 minutes?
I don't know, because we're going to have
so
to come.
So if you see a Morris, get back.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, it's
I'm not going far.
This thought, Senator Morris. Wednesday now, because DSL. So not until next Wednesday. It'll be up Wednesday. Division of State Lands.
We're going to have to.
Yeah, and they needed more info for Senator Pazansky.
Oh, okay. Cool, thanks.
Yeah. Senate revenue is adjourned until Wednesday at 8:30. Thanks, Barbara.